Here, put into quasi-eloquent phrasing, and with a jest adapted to the mental habits of the audience, we have the common-sense view of the ordinary prosperous man not only of Great Britain, but of America, or France, or Italy, or Germany. In quality and tone, it's a fair sample of British political thought in 1919. The prevailing economic system has made us what we are, is the underlying idea. We don't want any process of social destruction to precede a renaissance of society. We don't want to experiment with the fundamentals of our social order. Let's accept that. Adaptation, Mr. Lloyd George admitted, there had to be. Now, this occasion of his speaking was a year and a month after the armistice, and for all that period, private enterprise had been failing to do all that Mr. Lloyd George was so cheerfully promising it would do. The community was in urgent need of houses. Throughout the war, there had been a cessation not only of building, but of repairs. The shortage of houses in the last months of 1919 amounted to scores of thousands in Britain alone. Multitudes of people were living in a state of exasperating congestion, and the most shameless profiteering in apartments and houses was going on. It was a difficult but not an impossible situation. Given the same enthusiasm and energy and self-sacrifice that had tided over the monstrous crisis of 1916, the far easier task of providing 1 million houses could have been performed in a year or so. But there had been corners in building materials, transport was in a disordered state, and it didn't pay private enterprise to build houses at any rents within the means of the people who needed them. Private enterprise, therefore, so far from bothering about the public need of housing, did nothing but corner and speculate in rents and subletting. It now demanded grants in aid from the state in order to build at a profit. And there was a great crowding and dislocation of goods at the depots because there was insufficient road transport. There was an urgent want of cheap automobiles to move about goods and workers. But private enterprise in the automobile industry found it far more profitable to produce splendid and costly cars for those whom the war had made rich. The munition factories, built with public money, could have been converted very readily into factories for the mass production of cheap automobiles, but private enterprise had insisted upon these factories being sold by the state, and would neither meet the public need itself nor let the state do so. So too with the world. In the direst discomfort for need of shipping, private enterprise insisted upon the shutting down of the newly constructed state shipyards. Currency was dislocated everywhere, but private enterprise was busy buying and selling francs or marks and intensifying the trouble. While Mr. George was making the very characteristic speech we've quoted, the discontent of the common man was gathering everywhere, and little or nothing was being done to satisfy his needs. It was becoming very evident that unless there was to be some profound change in the spirit of business, under an unrestrained private enterprise system, there was little or no hope, in Europe at any rate, of decent housing, clothing, or education for the workers for 2 or 3 generations. These are facts that the historian of mankind is obliged to note with as little comment as possible. Private enterprise in Europe in 1919 and 1920 displayed neither will nor capacity for meeting the crying needs of the time. So soon as it was released from control, it ran naturally into speculation, cornering, and luxury production. It followed the line of maximum profit. It displayed no sense of its own dangers, and it resisted any attempt to restrain and moderate its profits and make itself serviceable even in its own interest. And this went on in the face of the most striking manifestations of the extreme recalcitrance on the part of the European masses to the prolonged continuance of the privations and inconveniences they suffered. In 1913, these masses were living as they had lived since birth. They were habituated to the life they led. The masses of 1919, on the other hand, had been uprooted everywhere, to go into the armies, to go into munition factories, and so on. They had lost their habits of acquiescence, and they were hardier and more capable of desperate action. Great multitudes of men had gone through such brutalizing training as, for instance, bayonet drill. They had learned to be ferocious and to think less either of killing or being killed. Social unrest had become, therefore, much more dangerous. Everything seemed to point to a refusal to tolerate the current state of affairs for many years, unless the educated and prosperous and comfortable people of Europe could speedily get their private enterprise under sufficient restraint to make it work well and rapidly for the common good, unless they could develop the idea of business as primarily a form of public service and not primarily a method of profit-making, unless they could, in their own interest, achieve a security of peace that would admit of a cessation not only of war preparation, but of international commercial warfare, strike and insurrection promised to follow strike and insurrection up to a complete social and political collapse. It wasn't that the masses had, or imagined that they had, the plan of a new social, political, and economic system. They had not, and they didn't believe they had. The defects we pointed out in the socialist scheme were no secret from them. It was a much more dangerous state of affairs than that. It was that they were becoming so disgusted with the current system, with its silly luxury, its universal waste, and its general misery, that they didn't care what happened afterward, so long as they could destroy it. It was a return to a state of mind comparable to that which had rendered possible the debacle of the Roman Empire. Already, in 1919, the world had seen one great community go that way, the Russian people. The Russians overturned the old order and submitted to the autocratic rule of a small group of doctrinaire Bolshevik socialists because these men seemed to have something new to try. They wrecked the old system, and at any cost they wouldn't have it back. The information available from Russia at the time of writing this summary is still too conflicting and too obviously tainted by propagandist aims for us to form any judgment upon the proceedings and methods of the Soviet government, but it's very plain that from November 1917, Russia hasn't only endured that government and its mainly socialistic methods, but has fought for it successfully against anything that seemed to threaten a return to the old regime. We've already pointed out the very broad differences between the Russian and the Western communities, and the strong reasons there are for doubting that they'll move upon parallel lines and act in similar ways. The Russian peasants were cut off by want of education and sympathy from the small civilized community of prosperous and educated people which lived upon them. These latter were a little separate nation. The peasants below, under the really quite alien incitement of the Bolshevik socialists, have thrown that separate nation off and destroyed it. In the towns, and in the towns alone, communism rules in 1920. The rest of Russia is now no more than a wilderness of barbaric peasantry. And there's much more unity of thought and feeling between class and class in the West than in Russia, and particularly in the Atlantic communities. Even if they wrangle, classes can talk together and understand each other. There's no unbroken stratum of illiterates. The groups of rich and speculative men, the bad men in business and affairs whose freedoms are making the very name of private enterprise stink in the nostrils of the ordinary man, are only the more active section of very much larger classes, guilty perhaps of indolence and self-indulgence, but capable of being roused to a sense not merely of the wickedness, but of the danger of systematic self-seeking in a strained, impoverished, and sorely tried world.